Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point on the American frontier. From east to west, from early to late, medicine was a rare or homegrown thing, and often as dangerous as the wound or fever that ailed you. From snake bite to snake oil, it was a wild frontier, and the seedbed of our attitudes toward medicine today. This hour on Point, Tales of Medicine on the American Frontier. You can join the conversation. Does your family lore include tales of wagon bed surgery, medicine on the hoof, fever and axe wound, and survival on the frontier? Would you have the grit to go mano a mano with a bear, a boar, a snake, tend your wounds, and press on? Joining me now from Norman, Oklahoma, is David Derry, author of more than a dozen award-winning books on the American West. He's professor emeritus of journalism at Oklahoma University, has twice won the Wrangler Award from the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum, and twice the Western Writers American Spur Award. His new book is Frontier Medicine from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 1492 to 1941. David Derry, welcome to On Point.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
It's great to have you. And oh, my goodness, do you have some wild and wonderful and kind of amazement-inducing tales in here. But there's so much. It's a frontier for settlers, obviously, but it's very clear in every page of this book that this is a shared heritage of medicine, that is, European arrivals and Native Americans. And I wish you'd introduce us right off the bat to how this word medicine came in to usage across that line, David, and then maybe read something to us from the painter George Catlin, who spent a lot of time right in the middle of this stuff.
Well, certainly. Medicine was not an Indian word. As a matter of fact, it was a derivative of a French word, and the Indians never called it medicine until the Europeans, the white people, came and began to refer to Indian medicine, and it carried over that way.
You quote Catlin saying, Indian country is full of doctors, and as they are all magicians and skilled or profess to be skilled in many mysteries, the word medicine has become habitually applied to everything mysterious or unaccountable among the English and Americans, and adopting the same word. And then you relate his story, which gives us an insight on what was waiting on this continent, of how the Plains Indians, their sort of fundamental relationship with what came to be called medicine.
Oh, yes. And I have in the book this segment that I can read for you that kind of explains about how the Plains Indians followed medicine early on. Mm. Catlin related that every Plains Indian male has a medicine bag. When a boy is 14 or 15, he leaves his father's lodge. He locates a secluded spot. He cries out to the Great Spirit, and then he fasts. At night, he sleeps on the ground. He may stay there from 2 to 5 days or until he dreams of an animal, a bird, or a reptile in his sleep. He believes the first such creature to appear to him in a dream is his protector for life, so designated by the Great Spirit. The young Indian then returns to the lodge of his father, tells of his dream, breaks his fast, and leaves again to find and to kill the animal, bird, or reptile in question. And then after killing it, he skins it and uses the full skin to fashion his medicine bag, which he stuffs with grass or moss or something of the kind. He then closes it and will rarely open it again. He will carry the bag throughout his life, frequently paying homage to it and looking to it for safety and protection. Well, Catlin saw medicine bags made from a variety of creatures, including otter, beaver, muskrat, weasel, raccoon, skunk, frog, toad, bat, mouse, mole, eagle, hawk, magpie, sparrow, and even a wolf. The size of the skin determines the size of the bag. When an owner dies, the medicine bag is placed with his remains.
David Derry reading there from his new book, Frontier medicine and relying on the observations of the painter George Catlin, who saw it firsthand in the mid-19th century. You define frontier medicine very broadly here. You've got a huge span of time from 1492, hello, Christopher Columbus, to 1941. How do you mark out, why do you mark out that great expanse of time, David?
Well, it's kind of mind-boggling, but when you get down to it, you have to realize that Indian history was oral and still is in many cases today. Mm-hmm. And it picked up and began when it was recorded by Europeans, and I use the year 1492 to signify the arrival of Europeans, Christopher Columbus, and, of course, the Spanish and others later. And then I carry it up to 1941 because that's an interesting date. It's just before World War II, and the way I came to this conclusion, and it was after I'd actually finished the book, that was the frontier period for medicine in the United States and in many other areas of the world. It was the frontier because they were still searching for something, and that search kind of came to an end in the early 20th century and very late 19th century when some physicians who had been well-educated looked toward science and scientific medicine. And the scientific medicine began gradually in the late 19th century into the 20th century. But it was World War II where this really mushroomed and grew because of all of the problems that were related with wounds and injuries, sure, and so forth. And so that's why I use 1492.
When that medicine frontier closes in a way, we're going to get out into the mountain man territory and the plains and all the rest. But you also define the frontier as sort of from the first step on the eastern shore of Europeans. When they arrived, what was the medicine that they brought with them? We got kind of a sense of the Native American medicine that was waiting for them. But they brought with them what you call heroic medicine, though it may not mean what it first suggests.
No, it certainly wasn't heroic for the doctors. The doctors actually, I think, looked for patients who would be heroic when they treated them, because that's really what it took. And I think one of the interesting aspects to this is that it goes back to the four humors. And what we're talking about here is really the origin of medicine in Europe and carrying over to England and then being brought to America by the early Europeans who arrived here. And this was one of those things that doctors believed you had these four important elements, and I'm just trying to find my note here. I made a note on this.
Well, you're very clear on what it was that they brought to address those elements, and it's kind of scarifying. I mean, bleed, blister, puke, and purge. You had to be heroic to bear up underneath this medicine.
Well, you did, and the bleeding was something that at that time was thought to be really important if you were going to have good health. And, of course, doctors didn't really know how much blood a human had, so they bled freely, and sometimes somebody would faint while they were being bled.
The New York Times says in your book the stories bring to mind for them sort of MASH meets Zane Grey and Edgar Allan Poe. It's partly frontier romance and partly horror story.
Oh, yes. I watch MASH. I'm a favorite for the reruns, and I often think about some of the things that they do that early doctors did, not knowing whether it was good or bad. But it was really an interesting period because, you had an imbalance, doctors believed, in body fluids, and this is where the bleeding came from. You mentioned the four things in action. What they had was blood representing fire, yellow bile representing air, black bile representing water, and phlegm representing the earth. And they thought that illness and disease came from any imbalance of these four humors. And I'll tell you, I would not like to be treated by a doctor who believes in heroic medicine today, because and there were a lot of people who did die, in fact, from doctors who practiced that extensively. Not all doctors did.
Right, bring on the bleeding and the blistering and the purging and the puking.
Yes.
And if you're lucky, you might survive. Of course, they brought their own European diseases with them, which decimated many Indian populations. But ultimately, you write, it became very familiar with the Native American way of looking at things. You suggest we end up with a kind of amalgamum, really, in our American attitude toward medicine.
Yes, I think there was an influence, certainly from the Indians. The early settlers in North America were impressed, and I mean in the United States and Canada, were impressed with the Indians' use of herbal remedies that were used to treat very simple physical conditions, broken bones, burns, sore eyes, dislocations. But I think the big difference, the majority of Indian medicine actually used cured people without having any physical cause, like a broken bone. Because Indian medicine, as I've told people, and as I relate in the book, was really tied to religion.
And when we get them rounded up and quieted down again, dark clouds will rise in the west and fire will play on the horn. The boss will say, stay with them, boys, your pay will be in gold. I'm bound to follow the longhorn steer until I get to
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about medicine on the American frontier, its wild stories and evolution from east to west as the country pushed out. My guest joining us today from Norman, Oklahoma, is David Derry, author of the new book, Frontier Medicine from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 1492-1941. David Derry, who performed medicine on the American frontier?
Well, it depends on what part of the frontier and what period. Initially, you had a lot of people who called themselves doctors with limited training who came over with the English. You had in the Southwest, you had the Spanish, you had Franciscans who really did a lot to treat people. But at the same time, these doctors and every European who came over carried diseases from Europe and gave them to the Indians. And I think this was a story that has been told, but I don't think told fully, about how many Indians actually died because of the diseases brought to America by Europeans.
Is it possible to put a number on it, a percentage, something?
Well, you have individual situations that are documented, and I suppose you can put all of them together and come up with a figure, but the ones that I found in the early 1700s, they had a smallpox epidemic that swept through the tribes in what is now New England. Mm-hmm. And you had about 30,000 Indians believed to be in the region, and all but 300 died from smallpox. Now, mind you, this is the early 1700s. And then you had the middle and the late 18th century when you had more Indians die around Boston in 1657 when a measles outbreak occurred, and then again in 1687. You had a yellow fever outbreak in New York City in 1690, and you had more Indians die. But the tragedy that has not really been fully told is in the Southwest, where you had the Spanish arriving in what is now Mexico and mm-hmm. in the southwestern states, Arizona, California, and what is today New Mexico. And you actually had disease spread rather rapidly. The Spanish Franciscans tell us this in documents that in 1638, you had 20,000 Pueblo Indians die from smallpox. And in 1640, you had another 30,000 Indians die. So you could add all these figures together, and you're going to have a large number of Indians die because of the disease brought to North America by Europeans.
A disaster for Native Americans any number of fronts here. At the same time, you've got these incoming populations struggling in difficult circumstances, to say the least. I mean, these are people in the middle of what to them was Full Wilderness, dealing with everything that life can dole out in terms of injury and disease. You tell this amazing story of Jane Crawford, what was it, 1809, I think, and kind of astounding first. Can you give us some of that story, David Derry?
Oh, yes. This was in December of 1809.
Christmas Day.
Jane Crawford was, you know, about 45. She lived in a small log cabin in Kentucky with her husband, and she thought she was pregnant. And it was very obvious. Her belly was so enlarged that the local doctors that she called in thought she had twins, and they were overdue. But she wouldn't give birth. And the physicians enlisted another doctor, a highly regarded general practitioner from nearby Danville, Kentucky. His name was McDowell. And he came to the little cabin, and he checked her over. And he said afterwards that, well, you're not pregnant. You're suffering from a massive ovarian tumor. And as he later wrote, he said, I gave the unhappy woman information on her dangerous situation. And he also said she finally appeared willing to undergo an experiment, although at first she didn't want to, but she talked to her husband, and the doctor, in effect, said, you'd better let us experiment because otherwise you're going to die.
But what she signed up for in that just beggars belief here.
Well, it does. He left the decision up to her, and she decided, and she took a two-day horseback ride in the middle of winter with a friend to go to McDowell's home in Danville. And mind you, this was a very difficult traveling time with winter weather, and she's sitting in the saddle, and the friction that was against the front of her body and the pommel on the saddle gave her belly on the front black and blue bruises. Well, she gets to the doctor, and the doctor says, well, we're going to operate. He gets three assistants, but he decides to do it, you know, a couple of days later after she's had a chance to recuperate. So what he did was to take a 9-inch vertical cut into the patient's abdomen.
Let us recall that there's no anesthetic here.
No anesthetic. She is enduring the pain by singing hymns and repeating psalms. And once the doctor gets in, he scoops out 15 pounds of a dirty-looking substance like gelatin. He then removed the actual tumor that weighed 7.5 pounds. He also took out the ovary and a portion of the fallopian tube. Now, once all of this stuff is removed, and mind you, this is an operation that had not been done before, and he was kind of going on...
oh my gosh.
It was an experiment. So he then, when he got everything out, turned the patient on her left side to allow the accumulated blood to escape. And then he carefully replaced her intestines, would you believe?
Which had spilled out during the surgery.
Out, yes. And he finally closed the incision with sutures and adhesive plaster.
Merry Christmas, Mrs. Crawford.
Yeah, that was about it. She received no pain medication. There were no antibiotics, no intravenous feeding. There was no formal post-operative care because such an operation had never been done. But she recovered, and 3 weeks later, she rode her horse home, and she suffered no complications. Now, she lived to be 78 years old, and she was literally the world's first known survivor of an elective exploration of the abdomen, you know, and it boggles the mind.
Kentucky surgery on Christmas Day, 1809, no surgery, 9 inches, and all the rest. Oh, my Lord. And that's just the beginning of the story. Not even the beginning, just one instance of frontier medicine. David Derry is with us. His new book is Frontier Medicine. Let's take a couple of calls here from Salt Lake City, Utah. Drew, you're on the air with David Derry in Oklahoma.
Hi.
What do you know, Drew?
Well, let me tell you, we don't know whether it's a frontier remedy or not. Part of the family is a direct descendant of John Alden and that group. So it's a question of where it came from. But we never use Neosporin or anything like that growing up. We use what we call sticky gum salve. S-A-L-V-E.
Okay.
Which is made from beeswax and pine tar and mutton tallow and a few other things. And what you do is if you've got a cut or a burn or any of those other kinds of things, you put that on it, and it draws out the infection, and it works better than anything that's there modern. You use it on animals too.
Drew, I have to ask you, where in the year 2008 do you come up with this potion of beeswax, pine tar, and mutton tallow? Do you make it in the kitchen?
Yeah, you cook it in a pot, and we actually put it into little half pint type of jars. It's got kind of a, it's not really lotiony, but it's somewhere between a lotion and something that you would rub. It's a lot firmer than a lotion, but it works, and it's a pretty normal part of life.
That's great. Drew in Salt Lake reporting there on what appears to have come down from his family. David, I'll come to you on that. Let's get one more here. Home remedy from Claire in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Claire. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Hi.
My dad got something from his grandmother. She was born in 1860, and he was born in 1921,
mm-hmm.
and I was born in 1961.
Okay.
And Dad used to use mustard plasters on me that he had learned from his grandmother when I would get a really bad chest cold.
Mustard plaster, real, like yellow mustard just on the chest or what?
Well, yeah, you take powdered mustard, you mix it with milk into a thick paste, then you put like three layers of flannel on someone's chest so that the mustard doesn't have direct contact with the skin.
Right.
You spread the paste over the flannel, and you put a couple more layers of flannel, and then you go cover up in bed. And you start to sweat, and you start to cough, so everything comes up from your chest. Your nose starts running like crazy, and so you just blow your nose and blow your nose.
Right,
and blow your
right.
nose. And after like a half an hour, Dad would take off the plaster, and he'd say, go run in the shower, take a nice hot shower, and you'd feel like $1 million. Mom hated it. She wanted him to use Vicks VapoRub.
Right, of course.
But it was... You feel like a new person afterwards.
I love it, Claire. Thanks for that report. David, Derry, there's just a couple, and we've got more coming in. But take us into this whole world. I mean, for my own grandparents, I know they often thought of poultices when things went wrong. But here we've got beeswax, pine tar, mutton tallow, mustard, and flannel working already. How did the frontier folk look at the utility of these, and what ingredients you might have there?
Oh, these things were so commonplace because most people could not afford doctors who would charge, and money was scarce. Most people were poor. These hand-me-down remedies have been and remain very popular today. And there are some superstitions that also are still popular. You know, most people then in the 19th century and certainly even in the early 20th century didn't realize that the body would heal itself, and it needed maybe a little intervention in between.
Mm-hmm.
And salves and plasters, Lewis and Clark's expedition, they made extensive use of plasters on the body to help it. And there are still people who use them today. I might mention that the doctors who were the heroic ones who used leeches in bloodletting, that sort of evaporated, but you actually have doctors today coming back and using leeches in some instances.
Let me read, if I may, just a little from, you quote, from an 1815 book. This just blew the top of my head off. The book is called Valuable Vegetable Medical Prescriptions for the Cure of All Nervous and Putrid Disorders, and you've got this one. I guess this is for gout and rheumatism. Take notes at home, ladies and gentlemen. It says, take a young fat dog and kill him. Scald and clean him as you would a pig. Then extract his guts through a hole previously made in his side. Mind you, this is from a medical guidebook, as it were. And substitute in the place thereof, that is, through the hole in the side of the scalded, cleaned dog, 2 handfuls of nettles, 2 ounces of brimstone, 1 dozen hen eggs, 4 ounces of turpentine, a handful of tansy, you'll have to tell us, David, what that is, a pint of red fishing worms, and about 3/4 of a pound of tobacco. cut up fine, mix all those ingredients well together, deposit in the dog's belly, then sew up the hole, roast him well before a hot fire, as hot as you can bear it, being careful not to get wet or expose yourself to damp night air or even heating yourself, or in fact, you should not expose yourself in any way. But I guess you're soaking up the fumes of this dog stuffed with hen's eggs and brimstone. What's brimstone? What's tansy, David?
Well, you know, I'm not too sure about pansy. The brimstone, I think it was a stone of some kind that they put in there. I really did a search and tried to find out what they were referring to. I also did a search to see if there were any accounts of people saying this works well. And I must say I didn't find any. it's really kind of funny because as some people refer to them, wives' tales or tall tales that existed in that time. There was even a legend in New England, which I ran across, and it was to stretch the scanty food supplies that existed in colonial times. And that was that they would give old people herbs and moonshine until they passed out. And then these old people, according to this legend, would be taken outside, would be frozen, packed in wood and straw until spring when they were thawed out.
Thawed out for what at that point? For burial?
Oh, no, thawed out.
Oh, I see. You mean, and they'd just be up as like too. A spring chicken. Oh,
yes.
Yeah. Well, don't try that at home either.
And there are stories like this all around. the one that Drew from Salt Lake mentioned is probably a salve. I have heard of several salves. I can't say the ingredients that he mentioned are exactly the same, but a lot of doctors experimented, and most doctors in America also in the early years were their own pharmacists. They had their own place where they would mix things, and they would do medicines in their home or office. And in many cases, the office was the home.
Of greater or lesser efficacy and legitimacy. I mean, snake oil salesmen common among that number two, and most of those doctors self-proclaimed doctors.
Oh, yes, yes, that's true, because you had, at one point, anybody in this country could be a doctor. You did not have to have a certificate or anything at all because they were not required by law.
1810, not one in 50 doctors on the Atlantic coast had a certificate, not one in 100 west of the Appalachian.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. A doctor's education in that period of time was essentially studying with another doctor. And, you know, every doctor's level of education and understanding and competency varied. So you might be fortunate and study with a smart man, or you might get a dud.
I'm gonna hit that Oregon Trail this coming fall. Hit that Oregon Trail this coming fall. Where the good rain falls aplenty, where the crops and orchards grow. I'm gonna hit that Oregon Trail this coming fall. Well, my wife gets sort of ailing when that mean old dust is sailing.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about medicine on the American frontier, its wild stories and evolution from east to west. As the country pushed out, David Derry is with us from Norman, Oklahoma. He's author of Frontier Medicine from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 1492 to 1941. David, let's take a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Cody. Cody, you're on the air with David Derry.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Very well, very well.
Me on the air.
Good, sure.
I just want to let you know that the Wilderness Medicine Institute teaches wilderness medicine today. I'm currently a practicing paramedic in Nashville. And a lot of the things that you're kind of talking about, using poultices and just common sense, you know, your foot isn't broke if you can stand on it and hike out 10 miles because you're in the middle of the mountain somewhere, that's something that paramedics are certified to do today. And there's not much of an x-ray machine out in the middle of the street somewhere, so a lot of times we just have to go by instinct and experience in the same way it sounds like a lot of those doctors did back then.
Cody, when you show up as a paramedic and encourage your 2008 patients to, you know, to take a wilderness approach, are they open to that, or, you know, they want something fancy right now?
Well, it kind of depends on where you are and what's going on. A lot of times you just got to say, we're almost there, we're almost done, and you're dragging someone out of a car with a broken leg. There's really not much you can do until you get them out on the street. So you just got to grin and bear it and you just tell them, hang in there, we're almost done, we're almost done, and until you're done.
Right. Cody, thank you very much for the call. Hang in there, David Derry, was no small part of Frontier Medicine. You've got some amazing stories of mountain men and fur trappers who had to treat themselves, who had to endure.
Oh, yes. There were no doctors going out with these trappers in the early 1820s. Hugh Glass, for instance, was one that I like to tell about. Glass had a wild experience. He actually had been taken captive by pirates in the Gulf of Mexico. He finally got away. He made his way north. He was able to go to St. Louis and sign up as one of the 100 enterprising young men to go out and to be really the first mountain men. Mm. And he got out west, actually, up toward the north on the northern plains near the mountains. And he got, his party moved ahead and he stayed back, and suddenly a bear showed up. He shot the bear, he wounded the bear, but the bear came for him and attacked him and really did a job on Hugh Glass. Well, about that time, his party came back. They killed the bear. They did what they could for Glass, which wasn't very much other than trying to make him comfortable and stop the bleeding. Mm. And they decided that, let's take him with us. Unfortunately, he's probably going to die. Well, they carried him on a litter, and at one point he went into a coma. Mm-hmm. And so two people, one of whom was none other than Jim Bridger, the famous mountain man, mm-hmm. he and his partner, who were assigned to take care of Glass, said, "He's in a coma, he's going to die, we've got to catch up with the group or the Indians are going to get us." Mm-hmm. So they went ahead and left him. Well, Hugh Glass didn't die, he woke up. And his back is infected. He knows it. He finally is able to crawl over to a rotting log, and he leans his back up against it, and he let the maggots eat the infection. You know, they'll only eat bad human parts. Well,
did that work? I mean, I never heard of maggots in rotting wood. Plenty in meat. I've seen plenty raising
livestock. There were maggots
wood.
There. He forced
some kind
them.
Of worm there. Wow.
Yeah, they were on him, mm-hmm. so he forced his body up against the log, and it gave him some relief. And, of course, the maggots fell off when they'd eaten all of the bad stuff.
Speaking of famous names, you got Jedediah Smith in here, too, from the mountain man
category. Oh, yes,
category,
yes.
And his bear attack.
Smith had another bear attack, and there were actually two Smiths. Jedediah and Thomas. And Thomas's story, I think, is a little better than Jedediah. He was able to survive.
Better in quotes.
Well, better in quotes, but also better because of what he became known as, Peg Leg Smith. He got shot, not a bear, but he got shot. And after the battle with the Indians, they looked at his leg and he said, "Let's cut it off." So he got the cook's knife. They amputated the foot, but they left a bone sticking out. And to make a long story short, he eventually had to do a lot of this himself, if you can imagine somebody taking a knife and cutting your muscles and getting it all
your
cleaned up.
Your own muscles.
Mm-hmm. He did find some help. Oh, no, no. You did. Mm. You were self-surgeon, you mm-hmm. know. It was do-it-yourself.
Mm-hmm.
They finally got the bone out, and some of his buddies made him a peg leg, and he became known as Peg Leg Smith and went on and lived to, I think he was 68 years old when he died.
Amazing. Peg Leg Smith, ask yourself if you've got the grit for half of that. Let's get a call from Newton, Massachusetts, and Nat. Nat, you're on the air with David Derry.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Just a quick, fun story about my Aunt Nikki. She was a midwife. And she just tells the most wonderful stories about being a midwife in the back hills of Kentucky and Tennessee and riding horseback through the snow and hiking for miles to deliver babies and, boil the water and get rags. And, she tells about losing children and losing mothers and,
yeah.
and, She's just an extraordinary woman, and she brought a lot of life into the world. And so it's sort of relating to
absolutely on horseback in Kentucky. We're so glad to be reminded of that, Nat, and thanks for sharing it, David Deere. You talk a lot about the role of midwives, and then ultimately the masculinization of medicine.
Oh, yes.
That they'd had a pretty good hold on.
Yes, as a matter of fact, midwifing is ancient. It goes back, I'm not sure exactly what year it has been traced to, probably back to the Bible period, where women helped women deliver babies. Mm-hmm. And the story about how men got involved goes back to England, where some of the people there thought, we have to make a living as doctors, but look here, all of these women are working for free out there as midwives. They may be given something for their service. Why don't we do some doctoring and deliver babies? So this was what they were teaching in England, and some of the doctors from this country were there. They were getting their certification and their degrees, and they came back, and some of them came initially to Boston. And they began to say, well, look, let's, you ought to have a man, a doctor, a full-blown doctor. And so among some of the upper-class people, the women began to shift to male doctors, believing that they were in better hands than with a midwife.
And the male doctors had a new stream of business, which they were no doubt happy to have.
That's exactly right. And I think it's interesting because you find midwives still in use today. And in rural areas, they're somewhat plentiful. And there are still some schools for midwives. But you find many doctors in the larger communities, and that's their specialty. That's
sure.
what they practice.
On that front, let's go to Abigail in Lynn, Massachusetts. Abigail, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I am working on my dissertation on a ship that sailed from Salem to California during the Gold Rush. And so I've been reading journals from about 10 of 60 men who went on this one ship called the LaGrange. And one of the things that fascinates me is that these were men who grew up in a prominent city of Salem where they would have had professional doctors, but probably most of the home medicine would have been done by the women in their lives. And yet when they went to sea, they were not experienced mariners by and large. They had to learn how to work on the ship, and they also had to learn how to help each other survive. One of the things that they used quite a lot was called hot drops, and it reminds me a little bit of Lydia Pinkham's potions, where hot drops were about 90% alcohol, 10% water, with a little bit of myrrh and capsicum, and it was described as a gastric stimulant, and that's what they used for almost everything on the ship, and yet they all survived. To get to California.
These are Gold Rush guys who had to figure out how to do it on their own. They had, at some point, would have been the example of Lydia Pinkham in your town there, Lynn, who made a fortune with her Pinkham's herb medicine later on. But men caring for men out of necessity. Abigail, good luck with your dissertation. Thanks for that. David Deere, I guess many people, whatever their sex, they just had to figure out how to do something in the eye of necessity.
Oh, yes. In families, the grandmother or the mother was usually considered kind of the family doctor. So it's understandable if you're taking off, excuse me, and you're a man and you're going to leave the female side of the family, you're going to have to make it on your own.
Yes, and the men learned it just as well with their hot drops out on the high seas on the way to the Gold Rush in California. Let's go to Augusta, Georgia, and Gail. Gail, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My grandmother was a descendant of a Cherokee woman and a Scottish trapper. And I grew up learning to use turpentine for puncture wounds and deep cuts and turmeric as something to keep the infection down. And it worked so well, I nearly cut the end of my finger off. And I put turmeric all over it, put the turpentine on, put the turmeric in it, bound it up, and it burned, burned, burned.
Mm-hmm.
And 3 days later, I could rub my hand fingernail across my gut, and you couldn't tell it was there. And this is not, I'm not joking, I'm serious, 3 days later.
So turmeric and turpentine, and it burns. You sound like Johnny Cash there, and 3 days later, you've got a miracle cure. Gail, thanks for that. David Derry, what do you say? These are passed down and passed down.
That's another one of these home remedies. There was one that started out, as I recall, as a home remedy. And when it got in the hands of somebody who wanted to sell it, they began to call it tiger fat. It was an all-cure balm. It would cure anything, they said. And it was supposedly made from backbones of Royal Bengal tigers.
Wow.
But the contents, it had turpentine, petroleum jelly, wintergreen oil, eucalyptus oil, and paraffin. These kinds of things, common household items that were found around, they were mixed together. And it's amazing that a lot of these things had some effect.
Grab it and good luck. Jerry in Nashville, Tennessee. You're on the air, Jerry.
Oh, great. Thanks so much. What a terrific topic this is. I'm a retired physician, and I began my career working up in the Appalachians. I got out of the military and had surgical training and started working ERs in the extreme northeast Tennessee and southwest Virginia.
Okay.
What I'm going to speak to, a lot of it has to do with the culture of these people, the mindset. You know, I saw a lot of folks with just amazing rashes from turpentine and all other sorts of things that they'd put on themselves and wearing a lot of herb necklaces. And the culture is so different. I remember one of the first patients I ever spoke to up there was a gentleman, and his complaint was he had pwned his foot of a night. No, he had creeled his foot of a night, and it's pwned up, which translates he sprained his ankle, and they had been working on that. He had a relative that I saw later, an old lady that was so much like Grandma Clampett. This lady came in with hip pain, and she had literally, we took the x-rays, and the bones were smooth at the fracture site. She had been walking on it for so long.
But the herb necklace is still there and still fully in use when you're up there, Jerry.
Oh, yes, and midwifery also. And a lot of this has to do with, I ended my career as a psychiatrist, and I see a lot of this has to do with the expectations of the person of the cure. You know, if a person, and also their trust in whoever was caring for them. These people deeply trusted people. They seem to overlook their failures. And also, these are very hardy people. You know, by the time someone's an adult, I think, and some of certainly in the 1700s, but even in some of the rural parts of this country, they've been exposed to quite a few bugs and traumas, and if they survive that far, they're pretty tough stock.
Jerry, those are wonderful stories, and thanks for bringing them down to us. David Derry, you make clear the same, that there's that attitude and outlook are very important here. I mean, these were hardy people in so many ways. Their expectations were such. They survived things that I get the feeling reading your book, a lot of contemporary Americans might just succumb to. I mean, are we really more rational, more medically sensible in all dimensions today with all of our modern
science? Well,
let me
give you an example. And I think about this often because I think every American who sees a doctor thinks about it. I can remember, and I'm in my 70s, I can remember when the doctor would come to our home. He had his little black bag. He dressed fine. He would come in, and there was a feeling I could sense from my parents that, oh, good, the doctor is here. Our son will be okay. Mm-hmm. And it was a strange sensation. You know, he might have given me a placebo or something, and I didn't know it, but I felt better because the doctor had come and said I would be okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you take that scene and you move up to today, and what do? You go to a doctor's office, and there you're sitting with a bunch of other sick people waiting to see the doctor. The psychology of the earlier version, I think, is much better than today. And it's interesting that you always had the feeling that the doctor, you know, you're not to go outside, you're to stay here. He's not to have any visitors, these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. The doctors back then, I think, relied a little more on psychology and common sense.
Of course, some different incentives there as well. You remind us on the Native American side, some tribes, medicine man failed, what was it, six times, his own life was at an end.
Oh, yes, yes. But not in all tribes, mind you, but in the Apache tribe.
Talk about high stakes for the Apache medicine man. What wonderful stories. We're grateful to you for collecting them and sharing them with us today, David. The new book is Frontier Medicine from the Atlantic to the Pacific, 1492 to 1941. David Derry in Norman, Oklahoma, thank you so much for spending an hour with us.
Well, Tom, thank you. It's been very enjoyable.
Listeners, you can learn more at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.